This is the Alien UFO Podcast, Episode 7, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. Our mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. This is the free version of the episode. The extended episode is 21 minutes longer than this version. And to get access to the extra 21 minutes, you can join the Alien UFO Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $7.50 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $4.50 a month, you get an extended episode every month. There are now 7 extended episodes available, but the back catalogue will grow every week. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and the links are in the show notes. And please check out my other podcast, it's called The Past Lives Podcast. There are over 190 episodes. On The Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. This week I'm talking to Paul Ascoff about his book, UFOs, The Real Story. Paul Ascoff is a member of the British UFO Research Association for many years and has over 50 years of experience in researching UFOs. Hi Paul, thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
Hello, Simon, and thank you for having me.
We're going to be talking about your book. It's called UFOs, The Real Story. And I read it and I found it fascinating. And I'm excited to see you make this connection between a kind of spiritual side of things and UFOs. But can you tell us, what was the first thing that got you interested?
Well, and again, something that I mention in the book is everything happens for a reason. And when you're ready to move on and when you're in the right place, you will be moved to the right place to move forward. And as a child, I had a very sort of Victorian upbringing, and we moved home when I was just about before my 11th birthday. Now, it happened to be on the edge of a very quiet village in the English countryside on the West Yorkshire, South Yorkshire border. And we're talking obviously a lot of years ago. So the skies were very much quieter than they are now with aircraft and everything else. But it also happened to be within about 50 yards of the local spiritualist church. So these two things seemed to coincide, where we got into a routine when we moved into the house, where my brother and I used to take the dogs for a walk. That was our last duty of the day, because my father was like, yeah, I mean, he wasn't cruel or anything, but it was like these Victorian fathers were, you do this, and as children, you just do as you're told. And we had taken our dogs for a walk. The neighbor's dog, he was a war veteran, only had one lung and was quite disabled. So we used to take his two dogs for a walk as well. So the last job of the day, bring the dogs back in, put them all away, say goodnight to our parents and go to bed. And this particular night, it was, I believe, early September, and I'd just passed my 11th birthday, and we're talking 1968, so a lot of years ago, before we had anything like police helicopters or even ambulance helicopters, and there certainly wasn't even the air traffic that there is now. But also, there wasn't the background pollution with developments. We were out in the very rural area, so the night sky was, for us, quite good. We could go out and see. Now, my father wasn't an astronomer or anything. He had a telescope, but he had an interest, and he liked to involve his children. So this night, we'd come back in, take the dogs, put them away, and my father was in the front garden, and we went out to say goodnight to him. Now, our home faced due east. So we're looking due east, relatively flat terrain you could see for miles. And as we're looking, the sky to the north was completely covered in cloud, but it ended with this abrupt cutoff where the cloud finished, and you got this bank of cloud. And then the whole of the southern part of the sky, from directly in front of us to our right, as we're looking east, was completely clear. And you could see it was dusk. The first of the larger constellations were just about appearing. So we're looking at the sky and my father's saying, okay, this is so-and-so. And as we're looking, the three of us were looking, my father's in the center, I was to his right, my younger brother to the left. These two UFOs suddenly came zooming out of the cloud and then stopped dead. Now, there was one slightly to one side and slightly behind the other. There was no apparent join between them, but they kept the same relative position to each other throughout. But they stopped, bang. They was moving really fast as they came out of the cloud. Then, bing, they were still. And when they were still, they were perfectly circular. They looked like, I would say, probably the size of a 5p piece at arm's length. So they were quite large, really. And they were this brilliant pearly white, and you could actually see the light from them shining on the cloud. Now, the three of us were sat there in awe looking at them. And as it came out and as they stopped, I got very clearly this voice in my head. The phrase that I got in my head was, oops, we hadn't meant to have been seen. Now, I got that quite clearly, and don't ask me why, but I felt it was a friendly, masculine voice in my head. They were still only for a few seconds, and then immediately they were moving very quickly, directly away from us, due east, to what was then the Thorpe Marsh power station, one of the Air Valley power stations in the distance, probably about 8 miles away as the crow flies. We couldn't quite see it from our location. It was just below the horizon. They didn't deviate position from each other. There was still that perfectly spherical, pearly white light. However, as they were moving away from us, there was sort of like an atmosphere around them, if you like, that sloughed off and came to like a little point, a little teardrop at the back of them as they were moving away. And that was the only thing that changed. And they stayed like that, the same position relative to each other, until they disappeared out of sight into the distance. And the three of us sat there, never made a muff. We were all sort of agog looking at the sky. And my father was the first to speak. And he just said, well, there's nothing that we've got that can do that.
And your father was in the Royal Air Force, so he would have knowledge of aircraft.
Yeah, my father was actually, he did his national service. He joined straight after the war, and he did 3 years, and was actually at RAF Duxford. And they used the Gloucester Meteors then, which were the jet which we used, that were introduced at the end of the war. So he knew about aircraft, and sort of through his interest, we kept that interest up. But the funny thing was, there was absolutely no apparent rotation at all, no strobe lights. There was no noise whatsoever from start to finish. They were incredibly bright. And what got me was, because it was so odd, so, for want of a better term, so obviously alien, it couldn't have been anything else. And the three of us were just open-mouthed awe watching them till they disappeared out of sight. And the first thing that I thought afterwards was, how come? It was like my subconscious brain accepted that they'd been there all the time. But that was another thought that went through my head. It was just like a confirmation, if you like, that they were present. But also, it was like, why don't the public know about this? Because it was so blatantly obvious and in plain sight. It was, why aren't these reported more? Why isn't it on the news? Why isn't it in the papers? And then from then on, I was absolutely hooked, and I wanted to know the physics of it. How could something look like that and move like that, as well as put a thought into my head, and nobody be writing about it? And that's when I got into, in those days there was no internet, or certainly no mobile phones or cell phones or anything like that. And you had to literally get on your local transport. As a young kid then, I had to catch my local transport and local bus services and go into the larger cities to even find a bookstore that would the stocked books on UFOs or the paranormal or anything like that. And even then you had to order most of them. So it was a real sort of foot slog and digging things out and trying to find things out, rather than as we are nowadays, where everything's more or less within seconds at your fingertips.
And the thing about that sighting is it was multiple people. That's the thing that investigators really look for, because if it's just one person by themselves, we all know that our memories can be slightly faulty and we interpret things different to people around us. But with multiple witnesses, you can gather a consensus.
Yeah. The thing is, I mean, my father's no longer with us, but I did talk to my brother about the sighting just earlier this year, just a few months ago. And he recalls it quite clearly. But he said he never heard anything whatsoever. I mean, they were silent from start to finish, no noise. But he didn't seem to get that connection that I got. So it was funny. And the other thing was, my father, it spurred him on. And shortly thereafter, Eric von Däniken brought out Chariots of the Gods, and which kick-started my father reading. That's obviously, I'm trying to find books and read books about UFOs and the paranormal, but at the same time my father got into Eric von Däniken, and so I'm reading his books as well. Now, on the other side of the coin, my father never, as far as I'm aware, read any of my books on UFOs, because I started collecting them as I'd go out and purchase them, and I don't think he ever read one of them. But yeah, as you say, it was nice to have three witnesses, and my brother and I still have the same memory, although for my brother it's not as vivid and he didn't hear any voices or anything else.
So your first chapter is about religion. So in a book about UFOs, why have you got a chapter about religion?
It's sort of relevant where I was brought up quite strict with on the religious side of things. And I was initially dedicated a Methodist, and then baptised and confirmation with Church of England. We went to quite high church then. You had to be in the choir, you had to do Bible studies, and it was just the norm. You did what your parents told you in those days. And it was afterwards, when we moved to this home, a few of my father's colleagues already went to the spiritualist church. Now, very conveniently, because it was only 50 yards away, my father sort of like, in for a penny, in for a pound, we'll see what happens, and then we'll go along with our friends. And as children, you go wherever your parents take you. So I'm not saying we went every Sunday. It was more occasionally we would accompany our parents, and the usual births, deaths, marriages and that sort of thing, christenings. But with the spiritualist church, you had a naming ceremony. So I've actually been dedicated a Methodist and baptised Church of England and named a spiritualist. And to be fair, I don't follow any religion at all. I think, in my personal opinion, religion is man-made. And although we know that there are good and bad in all religions, and if people stick to sort of the morals and the ethics of religion, then that's always a good thing, but people don't. And again, people try to make a business out of it, which is another, as I say in the book, God never wrote anything down. It was man that wrote everything down. So you only ever have a man's interpretation of what they want, depending on peer pressure and the political control and everything else at the time.
And so with spiritualist church, that's about spirit communication and evidence of the afterlife. And something you talk about in the book is when you saw a ghost while you were working in the mine. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, certainly. Just very briefly, I'll just retrace. At the same time as we moved into the new house, and very shortly after, when I said initially that nothing happens by accident, there's no such thing as coincidences. And we'd seen the UFOs, and it had spurred me to read and to gather what information I could. Now, think about it then, as a young teenager and as they are nowadays, very often you're very insular. You don't sort of communicate that well with your parents, and you're trying to sort of part of the growing up process, I presume, and you're trying to lead your own life. But I was one day, we didn't go to the church then, and I was going out to meet my friends. And as I'm walking past the church, there's this old guy, and I can remember him quite clearly, and I didn't know him, and he's outside having a cigarette in a brown three-piece suit, standing outside the door, smoking away. And as I walked past, he said, Paul, and I sort of looked up and thought, well, I don't know you, but he sort of acknowledged him, and I walked over towards him. And he said, have you got a minute? He said, I've just this for you. And he fished in his pocket, and he got this scrappy bit of paper out and a pencil. And he wrote something down, and then he showed me the bit of paper. And he'd just written the three letters UFO. And he said, I've been told by spirit to show you this and to tell you that you're thinking along the right lines. And it was like, I was dumbfounded, because I didn't really sort of communicate that well with my parents of what I was doing. So I'm not saying he didn't maybe know my parents, but he certainly didn't know me. And for a complete stranger to say that to you, I mean, it would have been odd for my parents to say that, but for a complete stranger to say it was a bit mind-blowing at the time. And it was like, and I don't think I actually said a word. And it was like, I was like, what? How could he possibly know this? And it was just like, thank you, and that was it, and I walked away. But it was like, it was a bit of a shock to the system, shall we say. But to go back to when I was working for the call board, I worked in the medical centre for a while, but like a lot of things, and when you're a bit younger, you tend to get bored. So after a few years, I asked my personnel manager if I could, as they were at the time, if I could do something different and go underground. So he put me with part of the road laying team. And what we used to do was, when they were making new faces, for the people that don't know, there's an air system that goes round the mine where fresh air is drawn in down the intake side. It goes round the face, and then fans draw it out, the return, and the bad air comes out, the stale air, which is usually hot and dusty, comes out on the return out the shaft. So when you're working with putting new areas in, you're working in the hot, dusty things, because that's where the where you're putting the machinery down, so that when they've made the face, they take all the heavy machinery out and they can start again. So we've been putting the lane track, and what we used to do was, there was air doors between to short circuit the system, where you could walk through from the return and the warm, dusty air, where we have been working, to get some fresh air, cool, on the intake side. So what we used to do, for people that don't know, in the mines in those days, everybody stopped at the same time. The whole mine used to shut down for 20 or 30 minutes. Everybody had a break, and then everybody started again. So the conveyor belts had stopped, the machines on the face had stopped, everybody had stopped, everybody had eat, and then everybody had start again. So this day, I'd walked through to sit with this old guy, and I can remember his name now, Roger. And I used to just sit and have a natter, give him a bit of company, because what they used to do was put more of the elderly people and the disabled on these buttons, the transfer points from one conveyor belt to another, just to make sure that the coal was getting out of the mines unhindered. And I walked through and I was sat with Roger, and everything was still. And then as we're eating our sandwich, coming towards us was this, it's like a drift, like coming uphill towards us, was this old miner. And he's just looking at things, and we weren't particularly taking much notice of him, and we're chatting away. And then on the transfer point, which must have been only 20 or 30 feet from where we were, he ducked under the belt and went into this old heading. Now, when they'd had old workings in the past, they used to seal them off. And what they used to do was leave a little area, maybe an archway, if you like, maybe 20 feet, 30 feet long, that's all. And then they'd seal the old workings off. And it was a useful space to put in electrical switch gear for the district that it was supplying. So we saw this old guy ducked under the belt, and we thought he was just checking the seals to make sure everything was all right. No gas was leaking from the old workings. And then he should have come back out past us. Now, after a minute, he hadn't come out, and then it got to 2 minutes, and we're sort of looking at each other, thinking, I hope he's not had a heart attack or something. So we both were thinking the same thing, and we jumped up and went round to have a look, looked under the belt into this heading, and there was nobody there. It was like, what? Now, it's not like you're in the street or anywhere like that, when you're down a mine, you're surrounded by solid rock. So there's absolutely nowhere or no way this man could have got out or got past us without us seeing him. And it was like, and I don't even think I was afraid at the time. It was just like, did you see what I saw? And we both sort of, Roger went first and then I did. And we said we'd seen the same thing. And it was sort of middle-aged, portly gentleman that looked like a deputy. He'd got a miner's lamp hanging from his belt. But it just disappeared. And we probably had him in sight for, I would say, difficult. I would say at least 30 seconds, probably longer than that. But it just looked like a normal old person. Then at the time, the National Coal Board had bright orange coveralls, which everybody wore. But even saying that, at the time, there was still a lot of the old generation that were ready for retiring that used to still wear their old clothes. So it wasn't unusual to see an old deputy wearing old clothes. And it was only afterwards when you think, well, that's quite logically what could have happened. But he literally just disappeared. Now, whether it was spirit or something else, but it was definitely a physical presence, even though we didn't feel anything with it, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you thought it was just some kind of recording or it was actually a self-aware spirit.
Yeah. Now, that's a very good question, because I believe that there are a lot of places that can, if you like, hold on to the energy of somebody. If you imagine one of the places I've worked with previously, and this was on nights, I used to do a bit of cleaning and security on nights between jobs, and I was at an old place next to Selby Abbey, and this old pub and a lot of the buildings around it were actually built from the stone from the cloisters of Selby Abbey. And this pub was reputed to be, haunted by a monk, if you like. Quite a few people have seen him, a lot of reports. And I never physically saw or felt anything. However, I do believe that it's quite logical that if you have, in this instance, a monk that might be in his cell for 50 years, who knows? Therefore, you've got that person's energy imprinting itself on the fabric of that cell. So it's quite logical in certain circumstances that even years later, somebody else can pick up on that energy, even though there's no spirit there, they're still getting that, as you say, that recording at the time.
Yes, through some process that we don't really know about, the recording was triggered to play back at that time. It's fascinating stuff.
It is.
So if I could change the subject a little bit. In the book, you say that there was a sighting where you saw two very bright lights in the sky that looked like car headlights.
Yeah.
And you contemplated getting the camera and then suddenly they streaked away. And it was almost as if telepathically they thought, uh-oh, he wants to get his camera. We better get out of here.
Yeah. Well, on that instance, that was when I was with my first wife, married the first time, and we had two boys, and we lived in Selby. Now, we used to have a dog at the time, and I'd take the dog for a walk. I was going to take the dog for a walk, and I'd actually been brushing him. He was one of these with two big, heavy coats. So I used to brush him most nights. And as I'm brushing him outside, I believe it was my wife that shouted first that spotted it. And if you can imagine through, not thick fog, but through mist, and just seeing two car headlights in the distance. And this is sort of what we could see in the sky. And it was like two slightly hazy white lights side by side. That how you would perceive looking at a car headlights through fog. But I would say from where we first saw it, from where I first saw them, they would, again, difficult to say because you've no idea of the size, but I would say round about between 5 and 10,000 feet high, and it's about 35 to 40 degrees from the horizon. And they were moving very slowly parallel with each other. And that's why I got the impression of car headlights. sort of towards us, almost to come directly overhead. Now, my wife shouted the boys, and the four of us were in our garden with the dove, looking up at these, and they were just moving slowly. And it was like, this is very odd, because there was no structure to them. Again, it was just these hazy lights. And as I thought, I'll go get my camera, see if I can get a picture. And then suddenly, exactly like they do on Star Trek when they go to Warp Factor, whatever, they just streaked away. And again, like on my first sighting, no acceleration, just instant, fantastic speed, thousands of miles an hour, if you wanted to put it into that term, and they just streaked away. And it was like, wow, how can I follow that? So that's when I took the dog for a walk. Took me time with my eyes mostly on the sky rather than the dog. And then as I came back in, it was a large dog, so we had 6-foot fence around the garden. As I'm bolting the gate at the back, still looking at the sky, they came back. And they came back in exactly the opposite direction, moving slowly again over the top of us. I shouted for my wife this time, and she came out, and we watched, and they passed overhead, and again, nothing apparently joining them together, no strobes, no apparent rotation, no noise whatsoever, until they passed out of sight and below the horizon, and we couldn't see them from our viewpoint. Now, the good thing about this is at the time, I tend to write things down or make notes. And it was only years later when I was with Philip Mantle, and I was an investigator for Bufora, and I went over to see Philip, and I was narrating the story to him, and he said, I can tell you exactly when that was, Paul. And I went, really? And he was like, no. And he said, yeah, it was October 1984. He said, because I saw them too. And as far as Philip's concerned, that's just about the only unexplained thing that he's ever seen. And he was working just south of Leeds in Morley at the time. And as he came out of work one evening, he saw these two lights. He says, and the first thing that, like I say to a lot of people, how do you know when you've seen a UFO? That's a good question that I get a lot. And because from my point of view, is you know immediately that it's something odd. You know immediately that it's not a planet or it's not an aircraft. And you're aware that there's this odd feeling about it, this odd aura. And Philip straight away said, it's something odd. He says, I knew it shouldn't be there. And he drove out trying to half keep his eye on them till he got to a vantage point, because where he lives, it's south of Leeds, it's quite hilly. So he was like looking over a large area and looking down on Leeds, really. And he said it was exactly like that, just one light to one side of the other, looking a bit like car headlights. And it was funny that years later to get that, because a lot of people, myself included, do see a lot of unexplained things in the sky. Some of them obviously are explainable, but when you see something like that, that's as odd and bizarre as that, people still don't report it.
Do you think they had some kind of connection with you the moment you had that thought to grab your camera that they would shoot off, or it's just a coincidence?
Right, that's another point. I don't believe in coincidences. Everything happens for a reason. No such thing as coincidence. If something happens, it's meant to happen. And if I may go on to change tack slightly to the electromagnetic spectrum, that I think anchors all things, even though we're not aware of it. We have around us now, the electromagnetic spectrum that we use, the normal visible spectrum and acoustic spectrum, actually accounts for less than 0.1%, which is an incredibly small number. Now, our normal electromagnetic spectrum that our science is aware of at the moment is you have radio waves at the top end, then it comes down through the infrared that generates heat, then our visible and acoustic spectrum, and then it goes down through the ultraviolet, and then X-rays and gamma rays at the bottom. Now, that's what we know about. But the cosmologists, more recently, obviously, are now estimating that between 75 and even as high as 95% of the energy in the universe is dark matter and dark energy. Now, if this is true, which I believe it is, we are only aware normally of about 5% of the energy that's available in the universe. And we only react literally on a daily basis from what we see and what we hear with less than 0.1% of that 5%. And there's all that rest of it that we can't even measure. We up till recently, we haven't even been aware of it. Now, everything, I believe, works on energy. Same as Albert Einstein, he said, everything is energy. So you and I, the computer we sat in front of, the chair we sat on, the room around us, everything has a magnetic field and they all interact with each other. So that's why if we met each other in real life, Simon, and we're having a chat, we know that when we meet and shake hands, you know instantly if you're going to get on with that person. And that's simply because your magnetic field reacts to their magnetic field. So you know if you're on the same wavelength. That's another saying that comes into it. But also, you also where people have this opposite effect, where you know, I mean, even though they may be very polite, you may not get along with them because they're on a different frequency to you. And everything that we do is energy. Every thought that you have is energy. And I believe that if you imagine, if I can take the listener just on a little analogy, imagine an LP, an old vinyl record player, and that is our magnetic field. So that is what we are aware of. And we are somewhere on that record interacting with the magnetic fields around it. Now, because we only see that 5%, ET, in my opinion, is completely aware of, able to control, able to manipulate, and understands the rest of that 95% that we don't even know about, all the dark energy and dark matter. And because they can recognize it and control it, that is where you get that control, where, as in my case, I heard something because it came straight on a magnet, on a wavelength as an energy into my brain. Now that's, I'm going aside here, but that is another thing where people never seem to have problems with language. Whatever ET, whenever and whatever country it's in, nobody, whatever language they speak, they don't have a problem communicating. And that's because they don't use language as we do, because our language is verbal and it uses our acoustic spectrum. Theirs is completely different. And because they understand the energy, they're able to put the complete thought and the impression and everything else, the whole picture of what they're trying to get over, straight into your brain. So your brain interprets it in your language. So there's never any dialogue problem, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, there's no actual senses being spoken. It's like you get a download of understanding and your brain makes up the sentences to explain it.
Yeah. So that this being able to understand the electromagnetic spectrum to this extent, that is why, to go on to, if I may, the UFO abduction scenario and the way people see things and perceive things. There's when you see these UFOs, we only see when they're within our visible spectrum. And there's different instances, many of the where people have seen like a transparent UFO. A good one was part of the Gaffney report in the US, where a young couple had actually pulled to the side of the road, they'd been arguing, and then they saw that like a disc shaped object approaching them in the sky. And while they watched it, it became solid. And as it became solid, it passed over some trees near to where they were, literally within like 100 meters away. And the trees burst into flames. Now, if you think about it logically, as something's coming down through the frequencies into our visible spectrum, it comes down through the infrared. So they're going to generate heat. Now, this object, whatever it was, then zoomed away and was out of sight, and it just left the trees on fire. Now, these guys rang the emergency services. The fire service came and put the fire out. The police came and took statements because the police have been watching this object. But it's just one of those things. In the UK, we had the Robert Taylor with the Decmont Woods incident in 1979. And initially, that appeared to him in outline as a see-through transparent object, and then it solidified, and then the balls dropped out the bottom and rolled towards him. And again, it's just indicative of how they're able to manipulate the whole of the electromagnetic spectrum that we're not aware of, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so there's an idea that they could be all around us all the time, and so you only see them if they want you to see them. And perhaps you'd be on the right wavelength and the person next to you, they're not quite on the right wavelength. So they just won't see it at all.
Yep. And that is another, you've just hit the nail on the head there, where because all of us are at different levels of development and at different frequencies, and that is why everybody sees things and you're able to perceive things at a different level and see things differently. I mean, how many times do we see where somebody sees something and somebody else doesn't? Or we get a lot of reports from, let's say, air traffic control towers, where they can see something, but it's not on the radar. Or there's something on the radar, but there's nothing, they look out and there's nothing to see. And again, it's just because they're able to control that frequency. And with there are, I don't know, thousands of reports of UFOs appearing, disappearing, suddenly appearing. And another thing is the movements as well. If we're talking about people doing regressive hypnosis, now I'm not an advocate one way or the other. However, Bud Hopkins, Dolores Cannon, more recently Kath Marden, and a few others having interviewed and done regressive hypnosis on witnesses have all said, the witnesses, all a lot of them say, how the craft, if you will, for want of a better term, are all moved by thought. They all say it was done by thought. And that is why they make me laugh when you get these programs on television and they get these supposed scientists in saying the narrating the official narrative. Well, there were no flight services, there were no heat plume, there was no obvious this, that, you know, and nothing can do that, and the G-forces would kill somebody. And it's like, what a load of rubbish. They've got no idea what they're talking about, and they're trying to put our physics on theirs, which simply won't work. Because at the end of the day, therein, I believe, without any question, they are able to control the magnetic field, because again, it's an energy. And don't ask me how they do it, because I don't know. I'm far better brains than I am sure will work it out eventually. But because they're able to control the magnetic spectrum to that extent, they can nullify gravity. They're in their own little pocket of energy. So our gravity and speed and anything else don't even come into it. So that's why we see these so-called going from, and the Nimitz encounter, going from sea level to 50,000 feet in a few seconds and all the rest of it. It's irrelevant. Doing 10,000 miles an hour, it's irrelevant, because they're in their own little pocket of energy. They don't feel it. It's just, if you now could control your thoughts and think, right, I want to be in Bognor Regis outside that nice coffee shop on the front or whatever, you can picture it in your mind and instantly that's in your mind. Well, being able to control a craft to that extent is exactly the same when you understand the mechanism and have the ability to do it. And that is why we see things as we do, and we only see, as you said earlier, when they're passing through our visible light spectrum. But even with the the ATIP sort of, dare I say, well, it's not even, well, it's just they haven't told us any more than we already knew. And they said, yes, it needs more money thrown at it. Yes, it needs more investigation and all the rest of it. But part of the full report, if you read it, they had, it's not just the Gimbal UFO and the Tic Tac UFO, but the others, but they had 80 reports of trained observers, such as pilots, seeing it in their normal visible spectrum, being able to record something on the infrared camera on the aircraft, and also seeing things on radar as well. So they've got three different mediums that they're recording these things on. And if you look at the report, there's like 80 odd of these that at the moment we only know three of them. So what's on the other 77 that they're not telling us? And that's just what we know about, what they've let us know about. And that's allegedly from 2004 onwards, never mind what's happened before then.
So you mentioned alien abduction earlier. What's your view on that whole phenomenon?
Yeah. Right, well, I got introduced to that by being an investigator for Bufora. And a few things happened at the same time. I was given an abduction to investigate in 1995 of four adults in West Yorkshire. And we had the Bufora International Conference. Bud Hopkins actually came over and was speaking at the conference. And I was very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time, and I was helping out, escorting the speakers to and from the stage. And I finished up having lunch, just Bud Hopkins and I having lunch together. And he said, Paul, I got into this quite by accident. He was an artist. He had his own sighting that sort of spurred him on, if you like, that onto that type of thing. But he said, I wanted to do it more for the counselling, to help people, because he was a lovely gentleman, nice guy. And he said, but when different people from whatever background they come from, whether they're very wealthy, whether they're very poor, whether they're just a poor rural farmer in Mexico, or whether they were from America with lots of money or whatever, he says, they're all telling you the same story and they're all going through the same. He says, you could almost make tick boxes. And when you're doing this regression, they were all ticking the same boxes. Now, when two people don't know each other, don't come from the same background and don't come from the same part of the world, but they tell you exactly the same story, he said, there's obviously more to it. And that's how he became hooked and eventually got into it and started writing his books and doing what he did. Now, I was just in the right place at the right time to meet Bud. To go on, if I may, about abductions. The abduction themselves, ET, because they're able to control the magnetic field, they are able to, if you like, know a unique frequency. So if you or I had been abducted, they would know our frequency. They would, because everything is unique. We all have a unique frequency. Therefore, different people remember things separately. Each memory is a magnetic field, a magnetic energy as well. Therefore, you get different people that are able to, like Whitley Strieber, however you want to pronounce it, how he recollects much more than he did originally. Calvin Parker's another one. The Pascagoula incident, he only naturally remembered the 1973 abduction with himself and Calvin. Yes. Charlie Hickson, that's the word I'm looking for, between Calvin and Charlie. But he actually had two more abductions when he did regressive hypnotherapy with Kath Marden. He had two more before then, and he's had another one since. But there's only one that he normally remembers. Now, he only remembers a portion of it, and I think that's because, in a bizarre way, if you like, is that an act of kindness by ET, so that we don't become too scared of, you know, being out of our comfort zone. And you get a lot of instances where people remember a funny vehicle at the side. They just can't recall what it was, but there was a vehicle at the side of the road, or there was an owl, a big owl in the trees looking at them. And I think they are able to manipulate your memory to, if you like, only naturally remember something that's more acceptable and something that doesn't interrupt your normal life too much, so that it allows you to make this compromise and move on. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about what you think of hypnosis for recovering memories, because it hasn't got a great reputation. But at the same time, I think people wouldn't be going under hypnosis to investigate an alien abduction if they didn't have normal memories that were not recovered through hypnosis. So there's got to be a reason to research that in the first place.
Yeah, I think what we, and again, as researchers or even investigators, what you have to weigh up is how much that's going to impact on that person's life and how, dare I say, stable or neurotic they are, to how much they can cope with. How much do they really want to know? Or are you better off saying, well, that happened, let's move on? But I do believe it is a useful tool. And unfortunately, the media and powers that be, in a lot of cases, poo-poo ideas that do have some legitimacy. And as my good friend Paul Sinclair would say, it's the truth with no proof, because all you have are these disjointed memories. When I investigated the abduction for Bufora in 95, one of the men there was abducted, and he said, what happened was, he said, we had this strange atmosphere. And he said, one thing I can remember, he said, how I put a drink down and then it wasn't where I thought I'd put it, it was somewhere else. And then he said, I can remember how suddenly it was dark. And he says, and I don't remember it, I don't remember twilight, suddenly it was dark, you know. And he said, if you had the memory as a VHS tape, he says, it was like it had been cut into pieces and a lot of it had been thrown away and the rest had just been spliced back together, but not necessarily in the right order. And he said, that's his abnormal, but normal to him, recollections and memory of that night. And I thought that was quite a good analogy to use of what he was being allowed to remember of that evening.
From what I was taught when I was doing my diploma in hypnotherapy was that perhaps 30% of memories recovered under hypnosis are unreliable or probably not true. The problem is you don't know which 30% is unreliable.
Yeah. And I agree to a certain extent with that. But what you also have to remember is corroborative evidence with other witnesses and whatever happens around it. It's like the, if you like, the media tried to cover up the UFO over Jerusalem in 2011. Now, we actually have 6 videos of that. One of them is a hoax. And just by, dare I say, by chance, but it definitely wasn't, the Fox News channel, actually, the video that they chose to put on the air was the one that had been hoaxed. And again, that was done to discredit everything else. I mean, this UFO was actually pictured on the security camera of the Jerusalem weather station. And Jamie Musson went out there to investigate and interviewed hundreds of people. There were hundreds of witnesses. So a lot of people didn't have cameras. So when you look at the photographs that were taken, the weather station information, when you look at the videos that were there, plus all the eyewitness testimony, you've got to take everything else into consideration as well. Now, that's not always easy. And from an outside point of view, when somebody like a news station like Fox just puts something on that's obviously hoaxed and is CGI, then people just dismiss it and say, oh, that's it, and then move on with their lives. And because it doesn't naturally impact them, but it's a plausible explanation. And because it's a plausible explanation, people, it don't come into people's lives. People dare I say, are naturally more materialistic because you have to put food on the table and put a roof over your head. And so because it doesn't intrude, it's not, unless you're an investigator or whatever, it doesn't come into your life. So you just ignore it. And that is how they've been getting away with it for so long.
And one of the things that I feel is that nowadays, I don't really trust any photos or videos I see because the CGI technology is so widely available. It seems like really photos and film from before 1990 is much more likely to be reliable. Do you trust anything you see on the internet?
Occasionally, yes. But I agree with everything that you're saying. I put posts, if I'm doing any sky watching, if I manage to photograph anything, I've had about 8 or 9 sightings from my own home, and I've managed to photograph 4 of them. And I put them on, I'm not banned off Facebook, but that's another story. I put them on when I get the photographs, and I've got a page called It's the Real Story, and I put all my sightings and other UFO information on there. So, yes, I know where you're coming from, and yes, it is difficult. And at the end of the day, there are some fantastic investigators out there that do put a lot of time and energy into this. There's no smoke without fire at the end of the day. There is a lot more goes on out there than people are led to believe. And I do believe we are surrounded all the time, but because we're only aware of such a small percentage of the energy around us, that is all we see when they're crossing through that.
So one of the pictures that I really like, see if I can get your view on it, is the Ilkley Moor alien picture. What do you think of that one?
Now you see, I'm not convinced on that one. I'm going to sit on the fence. I had nothing to do with it, so I've only seen the reports and the photograph after. Difficult to say, and I know it's one of those things where Philip, my good friend Philip Mantle's not convinced at all, and I'm sat with Philip on this one at the moment. I mean, had I investigated it and talked with him and maybe found any other witnesses, then yes, that would have made it much better. But when it's coming from such a small source, if you like, it's difficult to. You just have to take it at face value. Yes, it may or no, it may not have happened. And the other thing to look at as well is the location of where it was, and has there been anything there before or since?
Right. And maybe if it was truly an alien picture, maybe it was part of an abduction. I think that somebody was talking about that, about how he said he took the picture at such an early hour in the morning. It should have been dark, but there was light there. It was like twilight. And so he had some missing time.
Mm. That's another thing where missing time, again, is being able to manipulate our memory. I mean, obviously, the first case that came up to anybody's knowledge was the Betty and Barney Hill back in the 1960s. But it's still something where if you're able to understand and manipulate that energy, that is what will happen. I can't say that I can recall ever having any missing time. And that is, again, is that because you've never been abducted, or is that because they're very good at what they do?
Getting back to the alien abduction thing, what do you make of this phenomena of alien-human hybrids?
Yeah. Now, I believe, if I may go just sidetrack slightly just for a second, I believe, to go back to my vinyl LP, that is our energy and our life that we're on. But if you imagine each one of those grooves in the record, if you like, is a separate life. So that evil, or I'm not going to say the devil because there's no such thing, but purity, I'm not even going to say God or whatever you wish him to be, The hole in the center is purity itself. Therefore, we are somewhere, all of us, whether we like it or not, in one of those grooves by our own efforts now and our own thought processes, trying to improve ourselves through our lives and make our way towards the center. Now, I think that the ETs, with the abduction scenario and all the other things, ET are on exactly the same thing as us. They're just on a different record, higher or lower in the stack. And that is why we get this involvement between planes, if you like, between vibrations, whatever people, dimensions, whatever they want to call it. And it's just people trying to improve themselves, whether they know it or not. And I don't think there's reincarnation in some ways is a wrong term, because I believe that the soul, if you like, is eternal, but you have to get to that purity stage by yourself. That's why religion don't count, because whatever type of person you are, whatever type of religion you are, is the same distance to the hole in the center for everybody. So it don't make any difference what religion you are or how devoutly you follow that religion. It's how you conduct yourself and how you use your thoughts. And I've just gone off on a bit of a tangent there, but does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It's been great talking to you. It's a fascinating conversation. And the book is called UFOs, The Real Story, and it's on Amazon. Can people get it other places?
Well, I believe that Philip will have a few copies, but at the moment, as far as I'm aware, it's just available on Amazon. Obviously, I have a few copies myself, but available as a hard book, paperback, audio book, as an ebook, and on Amazon. That's it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for being a guest.
Well, you're very welcome, Simon. It's been a pleasure. Anytime.
And that was an interview with Paul Ascoff about his book, UFOs, The Real Story. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com, Alien UFO Podcast. This is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is an hour and 21 minutes. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, where you can find my other podcast. It's called the Past Lives Podcast. There are over 190 episodes, and it is where I look into evidence of the afterlife. In my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regressions. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you have signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast, with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bown. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.